This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. The Indiana Youth Institute's put out the IYI Kids Count data book for 2018, and we have the president and CEO, Tammy Silverman, on to talk about that coming up. Also, we'll talk with Nick Johnson with the website homesnacks.net. They've just recently put out a study on the safest places to live in Indiana, and there are a number of those locations in the top 10 here in Northwest Indiana. We'll also bring you to our conversation we had with Harry Vandeveld of the South Shore Leadership Center about this week's Vision Project session. And this week also marks 1 year since St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer announced it was suspending operations. We'll give you an update. Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. You want to know what life is truly like for Hoosier children? Well, the information in the Indiana Youth Institute's 2018 Indiana Kids Count data book can help tell some stories, including those here in Northwest Indiana. And to find out more about the data book, let's turn now to Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Thank you. Always glad to be with you, Chris.
Well, thank you very much. Here, get us started. Tell us in general here what the Kids Count data book's about, and what the information in general for the Hoosier State and, of course, and for Northwest Indiana has to show for this year.
Certainly. So IYI has been publishing this book for, it's our 24th year. So what it is the goal is really to measure overall child well-being at the local, state, and national levels, and really looking at the areas of health, education, economics, safety, and family. And so right now, Indiana ranks 28th overall, for overall child well-being compared to the national level. So one of the things we did this year is we kind of wanted to step it up a little and go a little further with this data so there's more disaggregated data by race and ethnicity so that we can dig deeper at the county level and at the state level. So there were a couple of improvements, and then there are always areas that we need to give some more attention to, obviously.
If you will, tell us some of the major concerns. I know they had some good points and some bad points, I guess, as it seems like every single year the Kids Count book goes into those here, too. We've seen some improvements here, but then we seem to fall behind in some others. And I know one area in particular we're very concerned about is the opioid epidemic. But tell us first about a little bit of good news as far as statewide is concerned.
Certainly. So the good news is, first and foremost, that more of our kids than ever have access to health insurance. And so we know that that has a trickle-down effect as far as lots of different components and indicators for child well-being. So health insurance is great. More kids are covered than ever before. We also know that our teen pregnancy rates continue to fall and are at an all-time low. So that's very positive. And the third positive, I would say, is that for the first time since 2009, the child poverty rate fell to less than 20% statewide, 19.5%. Now, for Lake County, it's a little higher. It's at 25.7%. So Lake County's a little higher than the state level, but it's continuing to fall. And so that's what is a positive. We know that we still rank 31st in the nation for the number of children living in poverty.
Are we finding any different causes, or are they still the same basic causes for child poverty in Indiana?
You know, what we are finding is that obviously the employment rate right now is strong and the job demand is strong. However, for families with children, the ability to access those jobs is contingent upon available child care and transportation. And those two areas are still a challenge for our families with kids. You know, child care needs to be high quality, it needs to be available to all families, and it needs to be affordable. So sometimes there's not enough available, and sometimes when it is available, it is cost prohibitive for those families that are, looking to enter or re-enter the job market.
It is good to note, though, they mentioned about the fact that more children seem to be finding health insurance options here, and that's good because we've seen some pretty big changes. I know in some of the programs like MDYs and others that have basically gone out of business here in Indiana, so to speak, so they've been able to find suitable substitutes to help families out.
Yes, absolutely. And right now, statewide, over 92% of our kids have health insurance, which means they're going to hopefully get that preventative care, those vaccinations, those checkups, the dental checks, all of those things that can prevent some of those bigger long-term health consequences that disrupt education and all those kinds of things.
Now, I know that you mentioned one of the bad points that we've noted in the latest Kids Count book that has come out. deals with the opioid epidemic. What are you finding in the various categories that this very serious problem is affecting everybody in the state, and most particularly Indiana children?
It sure is. And I think oftentimes one of the things that we're trying to highlight is the fact that, obviously, talking about the adult users and addicts is very important. And there's lots of great work being done right now to try to talk about the appropriate interventions. But the reality is we're not talking a whole lot yet about what this means for kids. And what we found was that the number of cases of child neglect, now, you know, they lump them together, child abuse and neglect, but in reality, we know that as far as the opioid epidemic is concerned, what's happening is a lot of these kids are having, they're being acutely neglected. So because mom or dad are addicted, they're not providing appropriate housing, they're not providing appropriate food, health care. Maybe the kids aren't going to school on a regular basis, and we're seeing more and more of that really acute neglect impacting the kids as a result of the opioid crisis. And so what's happening is that there are more substantiated cases of neglect, and therefore there are more kids going into the protective care of the Department of Children's Services.
I was going to ask if the DCS is offering information that you're able to get, that you can find out how these particular cases are doing, and in turn, more and more, as you mentioned, more and more cases of children ended up in custody or in at least supervision by the DCS.
Certainly. And I will say, the bright spot, I will say that Lake County is a little bit lower than the state average as far as the number of substantiated cases of abuse or neglect, and they do that on a ratio per 1,000 children. So Lake County is doing a little bit better than the state as a whole, but again, we've seen those increases. There's been a 58% increase in the number of children in foster care over the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. So when you think of that, that is just a tremendous number of kids that are not able to live at home anymore.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. The 2018 Kids Count Data Book is out this week, and we're finding out some of the particulars, in particular for Northwest Indiana. Tammy, let's continue on here, taking a look at the breakouts here in some of the areas that the book goes into more detail on. You mentioned here just about child abuse and neglect, how Lake County and surrounding counties are doing in that respect. How about for the child poverty issue?
Right. Again, for the first time since 2009, overall in the state, the child poverty rate fell to less than 20%. So that's a bright spot. It's right now at 19.5%. But Indiana still ranks 31st in the nation. So if you think, who wants to be 31st out of 50, right? That's significantly below the median. And the child poverty rate for Lake County is actually higher than the state rate. It's at 25.7%. And so, again, that's an indicator that we need to take a look at what is preventing those families, the parents and the families and the caregivers and the families, from, getting the jobs and having a living wage so that they can adequately take care of the kids.
Do you think that maybe over time that's going to improve, especially here in Lake County and surrounding counties, as the economy is certainly strong, and we find the overall Indiana unemployment rate is down, but we still have efforts to try and find decent jobs for a lot of people in the state?
Absolutely. And I think what we're going to find is that the jobs are going to be there. You know, we work a lot with the Department of Workforce Development, and there are right now there's a good number of great jobs, particularly in manufacturing and in those kinds of sectors, and there will continue to be a demand there. What we're going to have to talk about is how do we make sure that we're matching the people can get to those jobs? How mm-hmm. do we make sure that transportation's available? And like we said, for families with kids, particularly little kids, that aren't school age yet, how do we make sure that there's sufficient amount of quality care available?
Let's talk about education now. How do the figures look in the book and how they seem to correspond here to Lake County and vicinity?
Sure. Well, you know, when we look at the two big indicators that we look at is proficiency levels for reading for fourth graders and math for eighth graders. And again, Indiana is doing better than the national average, and yet that better than the national average is still something that I think most of us would agree isn't quite where we want it to be, that right about 40% of our kids are proficient in reading and math, and 40%, if you went to a classroom right now and said 40% of you are going to be okay on reading and math and the other 60% are not, are going to be struggling, I don't think as parents and community members we're quite ready to go with that yet, right? That's something we would, I think, all say collectively. We're not okay with just 40% of our kids being proficient in those two areas.
Okay. Now, taking a look here, and you mentioned some of this earlier at the outset of our conversation here about child mortality, and and Indiana is still ranking like that's near the bottom of the number of states overall, but Lake County is in particularly high for here. Tell us about the situation here.
Certainly, and I think most of us probably got a glimmer of this in the governor's State of the State address, that he highlighted the fact that Indiana currently ranks 41st in the nation on infant mortality. And there's a ton of factors that go into that infant mortality. It's access to prenatal care, access to quality nutrition, and those kinds of things. And so infant mortality has long been one of those indicators that kind of just talks about general health. And so unfortunately, that 41st ranking is not where we'd want it to be. And so in Indiana, infants are, this is a big stat, and I think this continues to grab it every time we hear it. Indiana infants are 24% more likely to die before their first birthday than the national average.
Wow. That's not that good news there, to be sure. So we find that out, to be sure. Now, from the information that we get from the Kids Count data book every year, what information is something that community organizations, community governments, and others can take advantage of to try to make things better?
Absolutely. And thank you, Chris, for highlighting that, because actually the whole goal of all of this, of all the data that we put out there, is to have those conversations in your community, to take a look and to analyze what are those indicators that we as a community, it may be as the community, it may be as a school district, it may be as a church community, that we want to work on. And so all of the information is available free of charge on IYI.org if you just go to our data center. And it's the whole entire data book is there, but you can also break it down and type in your county that you're in and get a county snapshot. And then you can even compare it to some of the surrounding counties. So again, part of those conversations are maybe Lake County right now, really the infant mortality rate is particularly high, but maybe there's a county next to yours or maybe one similar in the state that seems to have better outcomes. So starting some of those conversations of saying, what are they doing there and how might we be able to replicate that here at home so that, again, we can better ensure that all of our kids grow up and that they're healthy and safe and well-educated.
Well, it certainly sounds like what you say is a good place for conversations to start if they haven't already, or at least to pick back up again as we start a new year here in 2018. We've been talking with Tammy Silverman, the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. They've just put out the 2018 Kids Count data book, and it's broken down by county. So if you go to the IYI.org website, take a look at the information, and you can find out the individual breakouts per county as well, too. It'll get you started on some of the important conversations. And as always, Tammy, thank you very much for being with us and sharing the information with us today.
Always my pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The website homesnacks.net has just put out a study of the safest places to live in Indiana. And as it turns out, Lake County has 4 of the top 10 on the list. To find out more about that, we go now to homesnacks.net and Nick Johnson. Nick, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Chris. Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful. Homesnacks.net.
That's
there
right.
You go.
Well, it's a snack, you know. It's, it should be, I suppose. Tell us first, if you will, what is a home snack?
So home snacks are bite-sized information about where you live. So what we do is we take data that we scrape off of the internet, and we look at what it's like to live in places from a number of unique perspectives. So a lot of people want to decide if they want to move somewhere, and you can go and you can look at, you know, different metrics out there that are pretty common. But what we like to do is kind of pull up the cover a little bit and look at data from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of data, how did you and your team there help come up with this list of the 10 safest cities in Indiana for 2018?
Well, for this particular story and data set, we didn't look at a very unique perspective. A lot of publications will put out the most dangerous places and the most safest. All we did was we looked at the FBI statistics for property and violent crime per capita. So number of thefts and also the number of people that are, you know, getting attacked and raped and all the other major horrible crimes that happen, and just divided it by the size of the city.
Let's go down the list now here. Starting out, we'll start at the bottom. Number 10 is Lowell, which is, of course, in South Lake County. Tell us about Lowell and why you folks thought it was a very interesting place to put down on the list of one of the safest cities in Indiana.
Yeah, well, what's interesting about Lowell is it was the 10th safest last year. There's been no real change. But, you know, the property crime, so there's not a lot of property crime in Lowell. It's actually the third least number of thefts per capita in the state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. So it's a safe place to be.
Was there anything else that you all found in looking through the data that was interesting about Lowell to put on the list as well?
Not in particular. I mean, you know, it's relatively safe when you look across the board per capita. But what is interesting about Lake County, you know, I used to live in Indiana. I spent a lot of time in Lafayette, and I used to travel that corridor.
Right.
A lot of people are surprised a little bit, I think, when you mention Lake County, especially because of the location to, you know, the Michigan, Illinois little triangle up there. People have a certain way that they think that things exist up in that part of the state. But actually, you know, there's, like you said, there's four places that rank high statistically for being safe up there. So that's pretty interesting.
Well, I'm surprised about the fact that Lowell is on the list here. A lot of folks, even in Lake County, in the northern part of the county, have been finding places to build homes or have homes built in South Lake County, and a lot of people have been moving down close to Lowell, so it's not surprising that they should be on that list of safest places to live in Indiana. Number six on the list is Lake County's county seat, Crown Point. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, so Crown Point actually didn't really rank last year on our list. And part of that might be the fact that occasionally cities don't turn in FBI data or report their crime data. So the fact that they're up there isn't really that surprising. But we didn't have numbers for them last year, so we didn't really know how to kind of put this into perspective. But it's the eighth safest for violent crime, which means, you know, rapes and murders and horrible attacks. So it's very safe when it comes to, you know, number of violent crimes, and it's the 13th safest when it comes to property crimes.
So it's
a great place to be. You know, it could be a little chilly up there, but besides that, it's a safe place.
We're used to that up here, or we should be, to be sure. Number five, right behind Crown Point on the list, is the community of Dyer, which is not far to the north and a little bit to the west of Crown Point. Tell us about Dyer.
Yeah, Dyer was actually the safest place or one of the safest places. It was third. It dropped a couple of spots, but you know, I mean, super low crime rates. I mean, you have a 1 in 2,000, almost 3,000 chance of being the victim of a violent crime. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you live in Dyer, you're gonna have a, you know, your neighbors are probably gonna be typically people that you know and you hang out with, and if you do commit a crime in Dyer, typically, either you know who done it, or it's somebody from out of town in a place like that. So,
and finally, at the top of the list, just a few spaces up the list here, at number one is St. John, Indiana. And that, again, is now, I guess, ranked as the safest community to live in Indiana. How did St. John get to the top of the list?
Yeah, St. John is actually, you know, last year was also the safest, so it continues to be an awesome place. And, you know, it's the second safest for property crime. So, I mean, you have a 1 in 135 chance of being a victim of a property crime. It means if you live in a little neighborhood, there's probably a chance that nobody's even had a property crime last year, which even, you know, that's car break-ins and home break-ins. And that's pretty astounding that you'll have, you know, not very, very high of a chance to be a victim of a property crime. And, you know, it's the fifth safest for violent crimes as well. So if you add it all up, I mean, if you were to compare it to, we like to sort of to put things in a perspective, compare some of these communities to some of the more dangerous places in the country. So a town like Little Rock, Arkansas, you have a 1 in 30 chance of being the victim of a property crime. So
right.
There's a chance that there's on every street in Little Rock, somebody's the victim of some sort of a crime. And you have a, you know, almost a 10 times higher chance of not being the victim in a place like St. John. So congrats to the folks up there in Lake County. It sounds like it's a great place.
Well, the folks in St. John are probably pleased, and the police department likes to spend more time on getting with the community members and helping them be sure that they stay safe that way, too. You talk about the kind of data. You talked about the fact that you use the information from the FBI reports to help go through the list here, too. If you go beyond the safest cities of Indiana, the ones that are certainly in the top 10, which is where you find these Lake County communities are concerned, where do other big cities in Indiana seem to rank on the list, like Lafayette, West Lafayette, and Muncie, and Bloomington, Indianapolis, for example?
Well, typically the larger the city, the more dangerous it's going to be just because you have more people. But, you know, if you're looking across the board, you know, Indianapolis, South Bend, and Elkhart are the most dangerous places to live. Elkhart, probably for folks that don't really know Indiana, they may say, oh, Elkhart, that doesn't really make sense. But if you're from Indiana, you know that's not the best place to go for you know, if you want to start a family and be safe. It can be a little rough up there. You know, Gary and Michigan City and are also in the top 10 in terms of most dangerous, and I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. And Lafayette, surprisingly, is up there. It's the eighth most dangerous place. You know, you have a lot of property crimes in Lafayette. It's not necessarily a dangerous place for violent crimes. That's where I spent a lot of time.
Right.
But there are a lot of property crimes in Lafayette.
Do you think that some of these cities too, like Lafayette, West Lafayette, Muncie, Bloomington, they maybe get on the list because they happen to be university towns?
Yeah, and so you know, you're going to get a lot of college kids that are going to be causing, you know, some property crimes, is you know, stolen laptops and you know, broken windows and you know, everything that comes with, you know, a 20-year-old that's, you know, out and about in town. So, yeah, college towns definitely have a lot to do with it, although college towns have their own certain amount of charm. And there's you know, I've lived in many college towns in my life, and I would never live anywhere else. The fact that you're so close to the college life.
There are the advantages and the disadvantages too, and you get to work with both and learn both too. I understand too. Well, if you can give us a clue now, what's next on the list that you and the other folks there at Homesnacks.net are going to be working on?
Yeah, so I'm actually calling up right now. We have a list of the safest states in America, and you might be interested to know what that is. Every year we publish this based on the data that comes out at the end of every year, and these are all coming out from FBI crime reports. But if you're going to look at the safest states, you know, Indiana, somewhere right in the middle, it's number 30. Most of the safest states are going to be up in the Northeast. New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont are all safe. Idaho, Virginia is the fifth safest state so that you can live in America based on, you know, numbers. And these usually don't change too much. I mean, if you're looking at the most dangerous places like New Mexico, Alaska, Louisiana, Arkansas, and South Carolina are all the most dangerous places. Typically in the South, there tends to be a higher number of crimes that occur, and those usually don't change very often. So I don't think those would be a surprise to anybody. But yeah, Indiana's right there, sort of right in the middle in terms of safety overall.
Nick Johnson is with Homesnacks.net, and we've asked him here to give us the list here of the safest places to live in Indiana. And as it turns out, in the top 10, we have four communities in Lake County on that list. Nick, thanks very much for being with us to talk about this and for the insight into the latest reports that you and your colleagues are working on. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Chris. Have a good one.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The Vision Project asks the question, accused of having a big vision, and it's a project that is being worked on by the South Shore Leadership Center. And with us to tell us more about it today, we have the Executive Director, President, and CEO of the South Shore Leadership Center, Harry Vandeveld, with us. Harry, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, thanks for having us. We really appreciate it, Chris.
What is the Vision Project and the thinking behind it?
South Shore Leadership Center is founded on a couple of significant yet very clear principles. Mm-hmm. And one of those revolves around making sure that we allow for as much information with specific topics that affect the region to be presented to leaders so that they can, in fact, analyze and discuss and then at the end of that, create an activation or an engagement stance. So we are using the Vision Project as an opportunity to take a topic that's very important to the region and invite leaders from all over the region to come learn from outside of the region experts and engage with an observation paper that will be created by Purdue Northwest observers who are in the room, and to be able to make a statement to the region with regard to the topic. And the topic this year is on the importance of tourism and how it affects the quality of place in Northwest Indiana.
I think that's probably one of these topics that people make an assumption that it's always there, that somebody's always planning for tourism, but it is something that you do have to think about, and maybe it's time to do some new thinking. And I'm sure this is a great opportunity to be able to get these ideas together from everybody that might be involved in this and say, what do we do to promote tourism, to develop tourism in our particular section of the state.
Exactly. The more that we can spend time together in a room sharing, being collegial, and developing collaborative approaches, the better off we are. And in particular, I think one of the quiet parts of our economy that, as you say, kind of is an assumed motivator or generator in the economy is tourism. Mm-hmm. When in fact, we have to spend more time working with the Convention and Visitors Authority, the chambers, local businesses, the mayors and councils, and all of the government officials from Indianapolis on up, to make sure the region is positioned correctly to advance because of investments in travel and tourism. Facilities and initiatives, and for the region to, in fact, be the beneficiary of all of the good things that come from that. Mm-hmm. People may come in for 4 or 5 days on a conference or a tournament, but the assets that are created and left behind are all for the benefit of the people living in the region, and that includes employment. The more that we look at and view tour and travelism as an economic engine, the more we can really focus on building the right facilities, which employs the trades, and then employing the right amounts of people from the region in those facilities.
Now, the South Shore Leadership Center is going to be involving some big names in Northwest Indiana involved in this vision project, the very first one here dealing with tourism. By the way, the sessions where we're going to discuss this are coming up here, starting with a reception on February 6th, and then the big program all day long on February 7th. Harry, tell us a little bit about some of the people that are involved in this, and in particular, how they're going to be fitting together on the symposium that really happens, and where the real discussion and the real brainstorming can happen on the 7th.
You bet. February 6th is the opening reception, and anybody who's interested in being a part of the day, of course, we'll get the plug in now. Go to South Shore Leadership's website, and you can be a part of the February 6th for $50 for the cocktail party and come to meet and hear a little bit from our MC, Mike Schrag, CEO of Centere Bank, and Roger Rickard. And Roger is one of the leading authorities in the United States of America on conference and meeting initiatives for regions. Mm-hmm. February 7th is 8 o'clock until 5 o'clock day at the Halls of St. George, where we have a number of different opportunities for people to come to understand the importance of tourism and really get into the kind of into the weeds or get granular with regard to it. So we have a nationally recognized individual named Bill Geist, who serves on a number of different national travel tourism boards, and Bill will be giving his perspective on the region. We're going to look at a couple of panels with successes that have been found in the region. So reaching into and talking with folks from everything from mayor office to the national parks and other opportunities. I think one important panel that folks might get a real charge out of will be, we're bringing in the people that run the visitors authorities from Grand Rapids, Michigan, Indianapolis, and Rockford, Illinois.
Wow.
And they're going to talk about their successes as well as the challenges that they face as they advance their tourism and travel programs.
Now, these are people that are they're Sparrow's Body status as colleagues in the business, aren't they?
That's correct. Yep. And we wanted to, and we know that Indianapolis is a little bit outside of the apples and oranges kind of a thing, but Indy has such a big effect on the state, and we wanted to make sure that folks had a chance to hear what was going on down in Indianapolis with regard to travel and tourism. We, I think the other thing that may be very exciting for folks to be a part of is we know that the RDA has been sponsoring a feasibility study with regard to a conference center or a conference center hybrid to help meet the needs of the region now that the Radisson had closed up. And so CSL is the company, and Bill Kruger is the principal. He's going to share his thoughts with the group at lunchtime with regard to what he's heard in the region concerning the most appropriate place to put a structure. And alongside of leading experts nationally, Bill Sheldrick, and he'll talk about how the mechanisms exist for funding the creation of those types of buildings. So that could be really one of the real standout parts of the day. And then the last real outside-of-the-box individual, but a great thinker with regard to regions and what partnerships can exist, we're bringing in President Tom Haas, who's the president of Grand Valley State University.
Mm-hmm.
And President Haas is going to be now working closely with President Tom Keehan at Purdue University Northwest in the fact that PNW has become an NCAA Division II school. So as PNW moves into the GLIAC conference as a NCAA Division II school, we're going to try and find out from President Haas, who is the president of a university that's already in the GLIAC, how universities can really develop powerful partnerships and help the university and the region move forward. So really a wide variety of presentations and topics with regard to what I believe is something that all leaders in the region should have a good sense for, and that is this thing called travel and tourism.
Mm-hmm. This is, by the way, by coming up here with this all-day seminar that will happen on February 7th at the Halls of St. George, and it's preceded, of course, the day before by an opening reception. Something to check out here when if you're interested in finding out more or being participant in the idea of tourism and promoting tourism in Northwest Indiana. We're talking with Harry Vandeveld, who's the president and CEO of the sponsor of the Vision Project, South Shore Leadership Center. Harry, for folks that are not familiar with the center itself, I know this is the big project coming up here, but you're involved as an organization with a lot of other things as well, too, and some interesting things that are underway that deal with such topics as philanthropy and even working with nonprofits. Tell them about that, please.
You bet. And in fact, we are so thrilled to be a partner with Lakeshore Media with regard to our philanthropy roundtables. The Lakeshore Media was kind enough to record our first five sessions that are now available on YouTube. And we wanted to be able to make sure that we presented a fee-free opportunity for leaders in the not-for-profit world to be able to build their toolbox with a series of different presentations on everything from how to communicate your vision more effectively to how do you, in fact, become a better team builder. We know that non-for-profits in many cases are smaller teams with an expectation to have larger deliverables oftentimes than you'd think it could come out of a two- or three-person shop. And so we wanted to be able to help those leaders build their teams more effectively. And we look forward to moving forward on that in the coming year.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, we're looking to collaborate once again with Lakeshore Media as well as the Association of Fundraising Professionals of Northwest Indiana.
That's great.
The AFP-NWI.
well, some great projects that have been that are underway right now, but of course this one in particular that is coming up here, that if you're interested in finding out more about how tourism can be best organized and best promoted here in Northwest Indiana now and in the future, a great opportunity that the Vision Project, which was this particular project is being called, is starting out dealing this year with the idea of tourism in the region. And the project is going to offer its opportunity to find out more on February 6th, with starting out with a reception, and then all day long on February 7th at the Halls of St. George. And if you're more interested in this particular seminar that lasts all day and all of it, you can go on to the South Shore Leadership Center website and find out more and sign up for this too. Harry Vandevelde, the president and CEO of the center, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate all you do for the region, and we look forward to seeing you at the event.
Once again, South Shore Leadership Center is getting started with the Vision Project this year. They're focusing in this particular year of 2018 on tourism here in Northwest Indiana, and the program that's going to bring out the most interest will be the all-day-long seminar on February 7th at the Halls of St. George, where a number of people coming in, the experts dealing with tourism in other places, can offer some ideas and get some response here in Northwest Indiana. This week marks 1 year since St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer announced that it would be suspending operations. School officials say the college, as it was, is dead. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuggle reports, it's still uncertain if or how the college might reopen.
Just a year ago, students were shuffling to and from class under the towering chapel on the St. Joseph's campus. It's since fallen silent. The grounds are still manicured to look as if class is to be let out any second, save the concrete barriers blocking the entrance that read private property, no trespassing. Across the road in Drexel Hall, only 17 employees remain. They've been dubbed the Phoenix Team, working to get St. Joe's to rise from the ashes of financial ruin. Chief Information Officer Michael Coleman says there's been progress in the past year, but the future of St. Joe's is still uncertain, including how long the current, albeit small, operation can be maintained.
There is a presence and a pressure and a feeling that the clock is ticking in some way.
The college is currently negotiating with a bank to settle a $27 million debt. It was racked up by a group of trustees, most but not all of whom have resigned, whose financial mismanagement drained the school's endowment over the course of 20 years and caused the shutdown. School officials insist the bank negotiations are going well, but didn't give any details. Even if the school can clear that hurdle, the question still remains. How can the college reopen? Coleman says that's a concern, especially after the momentum of a continuous stream of students was stopped.
We do have the heritage of the college that was, but the flip side is for all intents and purposes, we're a startup with a set of ideas.
When the school closed down in May, the first priority was moving the several hundred students who hadn't graduated to other colleges. Marion University in Indianapolis took in about 80 transfer students from St. Joe's, the largest number of transfers they'd ever seen come from one school. Marion spokesman Mark Apple says the school is tracking the progress of students who use their two alma mater's mascots as an identifier.
And they've adapted really well to the campus environment here. They've kind of adopted their own identity. They call themselves the Puma Knights.
As far as the teaching staff goes, the college had to lobby the Indiana Attorney General's office to release enough endowment money to fund severance packages. About 200 employees worked there at the time of the close. So, facing an unknown financial framework with no student pool or catalog of professors at the ready, St. Joe's spokesman Michael Coleman says the likely solution is to partner up with another institution.
If and when St. Joe does reopen, it probably will be a progressive process. So what you'll probably see, if we were to sort of look in the crystal ball here at the moment, is that it probably would reopen initially as a 2-year degree institution in partnership with a 4-year degree institution.
Coleman says that might be necessary for the school to regain its accreditation. He says discussions about who to partner with have been ongoing since the close, but he declined to name potential partners. There's no shortage of Catholic institutions in the state, including Notre Dame, Marion University, and Fort Wayne's University of St. Francis. St. Joe's officials say they hope the college's differentiating factor will be that it's historically accepted students who couldn't get into those colleges because of GPA standards, money, or location. And Coleman says the academic staff planning the school's new model is being critical about how a reopening college could make its mark in a landscape where four-year private school enrollment is declining, so the school wouldn't be open for only a short time and have to close again.
What is the educational environment going to look like 5 years from now or 10 years from now? Not so much what was it last year or even basically tomorrow.
Association of Catholic Colleges and Universities President Michael Galligan-Sterl says that's the biggest challenge schools are facing. He says students are going to college for career readiness and to find meaning in their work. The latter, he says, is where Catholic colleges may have an established edge.
People enrolled in college today continue to search for a meaning in life, to find the role of spirituality as they encounter the human experience.
But Galligan-Sterl says colleges must find a way to provide that within a financially sustainable model. St. Joe's officials hope to release ideas for a restart plan in the coming months, ideally before the May anniversary of when the college closed its doors. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
Time for another edition of Eye on the Arts. Here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Mark Spencer, and Mark is a legend in the theater world of Northwest Indiana, and particularly at Westside High School. Mark, do you still call it Westside Theater Guild?
Yes, yeah. It's the Westside Theater Guild, 20 years strong.
And so you have been there for 20 years now.
Well, I've been in the corporation for 26 years. I started the program about 21 years ago.
And that was coming out of your being a faculty member at Westside High School?
Yes. Yeah. I was just trying to get my bearings, finding out how I could make some type of contribution outside of the regular workday, out of the regular curriculum, because the kids seemed to be so eager to do more, and I needed to figure out how I can apply those skills with their interest.
And you've been very successful at doing that.
Very grateful. The community has received our work very well. Initially, we were just with fingers crossed, hoping for 15 or 20 kids. Mm-hmm. And out of the gate, we had maybe 200 kids showing up for auditions throughout the entire city. Mm-hmm. And then the rest, as they say, is history. So I'm quite grateful for the support.
So these projects are not just limited to Westside High School?
No. 8 through 80 is our motto. And beyond. We should add that. So, no, it's for our young people, of course, primarily, but for their neighbors and parents as well. And we've utilized just about everyone.
How many big shows do you do a year?
Well, now with the adjustments and our experiences with our current status, we do approximately 4 major projects. They run concurrent with the school year. So we're talking roughly September, October, then a December performance, then early spring, and then summer, somewhere in there. Just four major hits a year is what we attempt to do.
So the big one coming up is The Wiz.
Yes, The Wiz is a piece that we're actually reviving from the Westside Theater Guild. We produced that April of this year. Mm-hmm. And my alma mater, Indiana University Northwest, the Performing Arts Department, I've had a relationship with bringing some of my works to their physical plant. Mm-hmm. And now with this wonderful new facility, we're reviving The Wiz in the upcoming weeks. And with that, we're very excited to reproduce this work. And
so this is going to be at the new Arts and Sciences building?
Yes.
On the campus at IU.
Absolutely. And I'm totally jazzed and excited about it. And the kids are, and community members that are involved as well. So, yeah, that's a big piece for us and very interesting to remount. I don't remount often. So when the puzzle pieces go back and the wardrobe goes into its own direction and mothballs, you know, take effect, I move on to other things. And to bring it back, it's just very interesting. It's like a lucid dream.
Mark, Westside High School's auditorium is enormous, though.
Yes, it is, actually.
How many seats?
2,000 seats.
Okay,
it's a
and
barn.
You're talking about the 500-seat
theater. On Broadway, the brand-new facility.
Is that what they're calling it on Broadway, the theater program?
Well, what they refer to it as is Theater Northwest, and its main stage is what they refer to it as.
Okay.
And
okay.
It's in the Arts and Sciences building on Broadway.
Yeah. That's a beautiful building.
It is.
And I'm just, I only mentioned that. It's so you have to scale down somewhat in order to fit on that stage.
Yes,
right?
And redirecting is interesting because it's I like to call it a thrusty environment, apron plus.
Yeah,
we're having to reblock because everything was proscenium and then upstage,
right.
And we rocked it from there. But now a lot of what we're doing with a permanent thrust, I have to redirect some things because we have 3/4 now to play to,
yeah.
And going beyond the proscenium, which is fine. It's just, sure. Again, as I said, pulling the mothballs off. It's an adjustment, and it's fun, and yeah, that's what we're doing.
And you get to have primarily the same cast?
Yes, we pull the family back together, mm-hmm. And they're excited about it because mm-hmm. they're county folks. They're from Northwest Indiana, mm-hmm. And they're happy to share their craft with the neighbors.
I loved that. I saw The Wiz when it was first touring back in the 70s, it would have been, I guess.
Yes.
Andre DeShields was, what was Andre DeShields? Was he the Wizard of Oz or was he the Scarecrow or something?
I thought DeShields was the Wiz, but I'm going to have to check Wikipedia just to make sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I know.
Right. But no, he's a legend in the industry, and Stephanie Mills, I know for sure, was Dorothy.
Sure.
And it was just it was a wonderful experience. I got to see the revival of that in 84
uh-huh.
as a kid. I was a student at Emerson School for the Visual and Performing Arts. And they bust us out there. And since then, as a 14-year-old, that show's been on my bucket list to actually produce. And finally, this past year, I got a chance to...
Oh, that's never had before.
I produced The Wizard of Oz, L.
Sure.
Frank Baum's
yeah, yeah.
The Wizard of
the
Oz.
Traditional.
The traditional, wonderful Wizard of.
Yeah.
But The Wiz, the one that's got a little sauce and pepper to it.
Yeah.
You know, I only got to do it last year, and I was excited about it.
And that music is kind of right out of disco. And
it is.
Didn't Diana Ross play Dorothy in the movie?
Yes, she did. The Motown production, produced by the kind people at Motown. Yeah, she did it in 1978.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was the height of the disco.
There it is.
My favorite epoch.
Mine as well. Stack shoes and all.
We have to go, but thank you for being here. We'll be watching for The Wiz at the Arts and Sciences Building on Broadway.
Excited.
UN. Yeah.
Thank you. God bless you.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And you can hear this conversation and previous editions of Eye on the Arts on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And you can join us next Monday here on Regionally Speaking for another Eye on the Arts conversation. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow.